This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Valentine's Day. Whether it's your favorite day of the season or you avoid it like the plague, there's no debating it's a big day for the world of food and hospitality.
Valentine's Day is what we refer to in the industry as a blackout day.
I don't feel that my manlyhood is threatened when I order a glass of rosé or, God forbid, a rosé champagne.
It's an old Jamaican drink from way back, and we just decided to bring it back into existence. A drink that the men, they believe it really does wonders.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. I'm Kat Johnson, the communications director here at HRN, and I'm joined by my co-host, Katie Mosman-Wadler, our executive director.
Hey, Kat. How's it going today?
Great.
Happy Thursday.
How are you? It's springtime.
It is. We've just come in from outside, so we're like a little extra jazzed up right now. We've got a full house in the studio. We have our wonderful program manager, Hannah Forden.
Happy Thursday and happy like first nice day in, a decade?
Yeah.
How long?
Yeah. It seems like a minute. Yeah. Also welcoming for the first time, making her debut on HRN Happy Hour, our brand newest member of our intern team, the wonderful Aaliyah Papes.
Hi, everyone.
Yay. So glad to have you. Second day.
Yes.
How's it going?
Great. So very far, so happy good. To be here.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, she came back for her second day, so this should say something. We're very excited to have you.
She didn't run.
And in the booth, we have Amanda Wang making it sound great. Hey, Amanda.
Hello.
And our guest of honor today, we're very excited, is Anna Moulet. She is the interim executive director of Slow Food USA. News, guys, you heard it here first.
And hey, everyone.
Yes, welcome, welcome. And
thank you.
We're going to talk a little bit in a moment about an exciting initiative that Slow Food is doing right now. They announced it yesterday. I'm teasing it. We'll come back to it. You don't want to miss it.
Consider yourselves teased. We have another teaser, which is that keep an eye on your inbox on Saturday mid-morning about, I don't know, what do we say, 10:45-ish Eastern time for some more special announcements from HRN having to do with our Hall of Fame.
The esteemed,
so that's coming out.
The esteemed hall.
The hall.
Of fame.
Of riches.
Do we have any announcements before, other than our Hall of Fame February announcement, do we have any announcements before we do our headlines?
Go outside. So nice. Do it.
Yeah, my announcement is it won't be February forever. That's what my calendar tells me.
It's
and
almost
I
over.
Believe it.
Yes.
I hope. I pray.
We are going to have a call-in in just a moment that I'm going to tease a little bit right now. We are going to be in Charleston for Charleston Wine and Food in just a couple of weeks. In just a few moments, we're going to have a call in with someone that we're going to hang out with while we're in Charleston. But first, let's do a few of our headlines.
Let's hear it. All right. New York City Beer Week starts on Saturday. So after you check out our Hall of Fame listing, get ready to drink a lot of beer. This year, more breweries from upstate and out of state are attending than ever before. And on this week's episode of Beer Sessions Radio, host Jimmy Carboni talks with Coney Island Brewing Company, Alewife Brewing, Island to Island Brewery, and beer consultant James Tai. So tune in to hear what beers and events they're most excited about and how to navigate the bounty of breweries attending.
Wow. This week on In the Sauce or In the Sauce, host Allie Kane is joined by Homa Dashitake, founder of the yogurt company White Mustache. We're big fans of White Mustache. The handmade yogurt was inspired by her family's cooking traditions and has attracted a cult-like following and a wait list of over 30 retailers. That is a good position to be in. She talks with Allie about authenticity and scale. Can they coexist? What gets sacrificed when your company grows and when it doesn't?
And this week, Dr. Monica M. White joined host Korsha Wilson on A Hungry Society to talk about the history of farming in Black liberation, her favorite restaurants in Madison, and her new book, Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance and the Black Freedom Movement. Monica is an assistant professor in environmental justice, urban agriculture, and community food systems at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I listened to that interview, and it is fantastic. You should all listen to it. And hint, hint, it ties in with our theme for Meat and Three this week. So you can do some pre-listening leading up to your Friday launch of Meat and Three.
Yes. All right. Those are our headlines. Just note, those are three of our 35 weekly shows. So make sure that you are tuning in to everything that is on Heritage Radio Network. All right, so we're still waiting on our call-in guest, so we're going to move in now to one thing we're super excited to talk about with Anna, which is the drumroll. Slow Foods Plant a Seed Campaign.
Yes.
Anna, what is it?
Slow Food Plant a Seed Campaign is all about biodiversity. It's about tradition and innovation and about getting flavor back onto our plates by growing your own food and getting new seeds that you've never tried before into the ground. So we put together these amazing kits. And this year we are pairing, to tease out the idea of tradition and innovation, we're pairing a seed from the Ark of Taste, which I will explain in a minute. With Rose 7 Seeds. Hold that thought. to kind of see the heritage seed community meeting this kind of more innovative, new breeding community. So the Ark of Taste is this idea of, you know, back to Noah's Ark, the animals boarding two by two and trying to preserve the animals from the flood. We're preserving seeds. So we have seeds that have been nominated really all around the world that are endangered. So, you know, we think a lot about endangered animals, but for the Ark of Taste, we're looking at endangered food products. So mostly seeds, plants. There are some animals on the Ark of Taste as well. And these are seeds with a rich cultural history, with a lot of stories behind them that really mean a lot to a local community, but have been endangered because of, you know, commodification, shipping. So, for example, the Long Island cheese pumpkin, you know, farmers prefer the round pumpkins because they're easier to ship. They're more, they have a higher yield, but the Long Island cheese squash is delicious and it's really fun to grow. And so we're highlighting that seed in the Plant a Seed campaign this year. And we're pairing that Long Island cheese pumpkin with Robin's coconut squash from Row 7. So Row 7 was actually started by or co-founded by Chef Dan Barber, along with a breeder and a seed planter. And it's a sweet little squash. It has, it's like a little round ball. It's really cute and delicious. Mm. So we're pairing those two seeds, and then we have a sweet pea from the Ark of Taste and Row 7, and we have a beet from Ark of Taste and Row 7. So we are sending these kits. We're currently, my office is insane right now. It's like full of boxes, and we have, you know, seed boxes, but also some, a little Slow Food Grows Here sign for your garden.
Oh, that's cute. So cool. Yeah,
it's a little snail on it. So we have that we're shipping out with it. And we're sending these to school gardens around the country. So a lot of school gardens, you know, have these teaching gardens, learning gardens for kids. So this is a great opportunity to teach kids about biodiversity. And we're sending them to chefs, to Slow Food chapters across the country, and then for individuals who want to buy them. So I'm really excited. This campaign has like been in the works for a very long time, and now I'm like giving birth to the campaign, and it's live. So
how much is it to buy if you're an individual?
It's $35 for an individual. So that's amazing. Six seed packets, wow, plus a sign and a very cool poster and some other swag.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So what's the importance behind the innovation and tradition? And like why choose seeds to represent those two things?
Yeah, so tradition and innovation, I mean, I think often like heritage seed is or heritage foods are pitted against technology and food. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, forward motion with startups doing, you know, these interesting food businesses, and we don't want to set tradition against innovation. We want to see how they work hand in hand. And really, it's all about flavor. It's all about biodiversity and how important, like, increasing the options that we have on our plate are to today. And this year, you know, we're focused more on tradition, innovation, and flavor. Last year, the Plant a Seed campaign was really focused on climate change, which is such an important topic, so key today. But we found it's a bit of a hard conversation starter with some people. It can get pretty heavy pretty quickly. So looking at biodiversity is tied to more directly to flavor and just like, this is delicious. You should just eat it because it tastes good. That gets you into the conversation. And then you can have those more maybe in-depth conversations about climate change and what it means to the planet.
And so how, if someone is just starting their garden for the first time and they want to get the kit and use that to like kickstart their garden and they don't know if they have a green thumb or not, are these fairly easy plants to grow?
Yes, these are fairly easy. And we have some guidelines and instructions for how to get you started. We have a Facebook group for some network support for, you know, if you're struggling with something, you can ask a question. And there's a lot of expert gardeners on there, too.
Was it challenging to find seeds that would grow in every region that your members are in the U.S.?
Yeah, this is a challenge of being a national organization, right? You have to find seeds that start that do well in Texas all the way to New York here in the snow. And I think that was some of the criteria for choosing these seeds. They had to be easy to grow. They had to work well across the United States, and they had to be fun and delicious, basically. So I think I'm pretty confident in these choices. I'm going to grow them myself, so we'll see. I'll report back at the at the end of the summer and let you know how easy they were to grow. But it should be fun.
And you're based in New York, so you're growing these seeds in New York.
Yes, I have a little deck, and so I'm a container gardener. We'll see how it goes.
Wow, I'm impressed by that. I don't have a deck, so I wouldn't know where to grow them.
I have a toddler, Hudson, so I'm going to teach him how to. Nice. I'm excited for the peas especially, actually, because he likes peas, and I think he'll be excited for those.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, Anna, you are the interim executive director of Slow Food USA pretty recently. Before that, your position was the director of communications and campaigns.
That's right.
So I assume that you're still obviously doing a lot with that, with Plant a Seed and with Slow Food Nations. But so tell us about your role with communications and strategy and the campaigns, and then like what you're currently working on beyond the Plant a Seed campaign.
Yeah, well, the mission of Slow Food USA is really around campaigns like this Plant a Seed campaign, events like Slow Food Nations, and partnerships, you know, working with different individuals, companies, other nonprofits who are aligned with us. So a big part of what we're doing this spring is Slow Food Nations. This is our annual festival, international festival in Denver, Colorado. We loved having Heritage Radio on site last year. And
so much fun.
Yeah, it was great. And it brings together, you know, farmers and foodies, chefs and growers and kids and, you know, all sorts of people under this banner of good, clean and fair food. So we're really excited for another banner year of Slow Food Nations, and having you guys back at the festival will be amazing. So between the campaign and the festival, that's pretty much consuming my world these days.
Oh, yeah. For those who aren't familiar with Slow Food Nations, can you kind of give a quick synopsis on why it's in Denver? What about Denver makes it such a cool event? And kind of a quick overview of what people can expect when they walk through downtown Denver on Slow Food Nations weekend.
So Slow Food is actually an international organization. It started in Italy, and in Italy every other year they have a big event called Terra Madre, Salone del Gusto. And that brings together Slow Food leaders from around the world and merchants and exhibitors and so many tastings and workshops. And so Slow Food Nations was modeled off of Terra Madre. We do it every year. And we chose Denver because it's a really interesting model of agriculture and cuisine in our country today. It's not a coastal city. You're not getting kind of the coastal elites of New York and San Francisco, you're getting kind of middle America, but in a city that's growing really quickly. There's a lot of chefs and media and producers moving there. You look at the skyline of Denver and it's just exploding. It's so much happening there. So we found a lot of amazing partners in Denver. The city of Denver, the Visit Denver, the Tourism Bureau have been amazing partners. So we found a warm reception there and we're excited to keep going there in Denver. In terms of what people can expect, we closed down downtown Denver in Larimer Square. We have about a four block footprint. And this year we are mixing in our merchants. So we have about 100 producers of good food come and sample and taste and share their stories with people. And then we have workshops, we have taste demos, we have a kitchen counter, we'll do cooking demos, we have free talks. So there's a lot of free activities, kids activities and fun family activities, karaoke we had last year, it was really fun. And then it's a mix of like that very public facing, fun food education mixed with like a deeper dive about issues today. So last year we did a talk about Me Too in the food movement. We did a talk about regenerative agriculture. We do these deeper dive talks for people who really want to go to the next level with food. And on the Friday we have a leader summit. So we have slow food leaders from around the country come together, but also people who are really working in food. And that's a chance to come together around specific topics. So we talk about biodiversity or climate change or school gardens and that kind of policy, those kinds of issues.
Awesome. And there's also, did you mention a leadership summit?
Yeah, the leader summit is on Friday.
Yes.
Yep. And we have some parties too, of course. It's about good food tasting. So we have a Colorado Made party on Friday night. We have another party Saturday night. We have this really fun zero waste family meal on Sunday afternoon, which basically takes food that would have been wasted over the weekend. And a group of chefs come together and create these really amazing recipes, repurposed food waste from the festival and serve it up family style. It's one of our like favorite events, signature events.
Yeah. What are you most excited to eat in Denver?
In Denver? Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that just seeing like the some of the international groups come in. We have some international slow food groups. And last year we had an interesting sake producer come in from Japan who had a great story about, producing sake through the some natural disasters there. So that's been a really interesting, I think the more that story is tied to food, it creates a more interesting landscape on your plate. Yeah.
We agree.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And Denver is just like a really awesome city to like want to spend extra time in. I got to go in a couple days early last year and, I ate a lot of really good Mexican food. So nice. For anyone who's going out for Slow Food Nations, I say give yourself some time to enjoy some green chili burritos.
I need to learn from you. I feel like we do a lot of working when we're out there. So
I'll bring you some burritos.
Yeah, bring me some.
You got it.
Okay,
you got it.
Perfect.
And maybe a cinnamon roll.
Yeah. A cinnamon roll.
Wasn't that the place?
Oh, yeah. We went to that amazing roadside place right before we went to the airport, remember?
Oh, my
gosh. Yeah, you guys told me about it. And you didn't bring
me one. It was
really
good. That was
it was a total greasy spoon.
Mm-hmm.
It was what you need after a long festival weekend.
Perfect.
Of celebrating good food. It's like some like kind of not good food, but like kind of great.
And it was better than airport food would have been. So I think it really saved us from that.
Yeah. All right. So let's take a super short break. We'll come back. We'll talk more slow food and maybe we'll have that call in and then we'll play some trivia. All right. We'll be right back.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage!
Welcome back to HRN Happy Hour. My name's Kat Johnson. I'm here with the rest of the HRN crew. And our guest today is Anna Mulay, the Interim Executive Director of Slow Food USA. And we were just chatting about Slow Food Nations. One thing we didn't cover is when Slow Food Nations is happening this year.
Oh, of course.
We should talk about that.
Slow Food Nations is July 19th through 21st in Denver, Colorado. And tickets just went on sale for the Leader Summit. The rest of our programming will be announced May 1st. So the full lineup of both free talks and paid workshops. So it's a mix. It's like free entry to the event. Lots to do for free. Lots of tasting and fun to be had. But we do have some ticketed workshops, demos, and talks.
And let's talk a little bit more about the Leader Summit, because I think that it's something that people might feel is like only focused towards the industry, but is it open to the public as well?
It's totally open. Yeah, it's a great mix of students who are just interested in the food movement, slow food leaders who are, you know, involved in their local chapters, but also people interested in policy or school gardens or biodiversity. So it's a pretty interesting mix of folks and a great place for networking.
We went to a really interesting event at the Leader Summit last year, where it was Kate Cox from the New Food Economy. They've done a ton of work last year. They really like focused on meat on their publication. And so she led a conversation among a lot of meat experts. And not only were there experts in the panel, but also in the audience. So you really got the question and answer almost turned into like a 101 on meat consumption. Mm-hmm. So it's super special because you're truly in a room with like everyone who has something to contribute. It's not just like listening to experts on stage. Although then you go into like the last event of the day where you have Raj Patel, and you're like, he's like one of the smartest people in any room he's in. So it's a super cool experience. And will it be at Johnson & Wales again?
We're still figuring that out, the location. It'll be at a similar kind of space. We have to confirm the details. But I think it's a great way to meet new people. But like you say, it's real, you know, it's a mix of people who are just new to the conversation but really want to dig in and learn more, and then people who have been doing this for years and who have a lot to say and a lot of interesting feedback for the panels. It's a good time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were mentioning earlier that a big part of your role is also really trying to introduce people to slow food who have never heard of it before. What's like the inherent challenge in that when someone's like, well, what is slow food? And you want to just say, well, it's what it says. It's slow food. But how do you get people to kind of come into the fold for the first time?
You know, that's a great question. I think starting with flavor is a really natural place, especially for kids and really for anyone. It's about having an amazing eating experience. And if you can start there with, where did that food come from? And then you start telling the story of that food. You make the connection between the eater and the producer or the farmer. How do we get from, how did this food get there? So I think it's a lot about storytelling. That's why I love the Arc of Taste and this Plant a Seed campaign, because we start with flavor and start with, let's actually grow this food now and take that step. But we try to create some really simple calls to action to help people engage and take that next step. So, for example, last year we've worked with Meatless Monday, and that's a very simple campaign, right? Just cut out meat once a week, period, or food waste, spend a week thinking about food waste and reducing, the food that's wasted. So we're trying to create these very simple calls to action. That's not like, blow up your life and move to, a farm and start farming. But like every day we make choices with our fork. We make political choices. We make really important environmental decisions. And how can we be smarter about that?
And then, so you work at the national level with Slow Food, but can you explain a little bit about the chapters and the structure of the organization in that way?
Yeah. So Slow Food, the mothership of Slow Food is in Italy. Slow Food International is based in Bra, Italy. And we work really closely with them. So, for example, even working with these campaigns, okay, how can we launch those internationally and work together more and more? So then Slow Food USA is the national, and then local chapters, we have about 150 local chapters throughout the U.S. There's local chapters all over the world, but in the U.S. it's about 150. And they have varying, every chapter really changes its programming and focus based on what's important in that community and what's important to the leadership of that chapter. So some chapters are really focused on school gardens, for example. Some are really focused on policy and advocacy. Some are more focused on chefs and restaurant communities. So it really depends. Here in New York, for example, they work with a school in East New York called the Ujima Garden. They do some amazing programming, summer camps with kids out there. So it really depends on what's happening in the local community.
And that sort of like mission is just really set at a local level. Like how, in what way does the national organization like influence local chapters in any capacity?
Yeah, I mean, we all are under this banner of good, clean, and fair food for all. That's the underpinning of all the slow food work. And so we, you know, that mission is across the slow food movement, whether it's international or local. And so that kind of guides the work of all the local chapters.
Awesome. And if someone wants to get involved in a local chapter, how can they find out about it?
Yeah, we have a listing of the local chapters on our website. And there are, if you don't find a chapter, you can start one or get involved. We have membership. So to be a member of Slow Food, you get discounts at events and campaigns like this and can be an active supporter of the movement. And yeah, there's a lot of opportunities to be involved. It's a network of volunteers. So it's the kind of thing where if you don't see something, you can make it happen. It's awesome. Pretty interesting.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Well, Anna, we're going to press pause for 1 second. Okay. We're going to come back. Don't get too relaxed, though, because we're playing trivia in a minute. Okay. Right now, we're super excited. We have that call-in guest we've been teasing. Chef Greg Collier is the chef at Uptown Yoke, a chef-driven breakfast restaurant at 7th Street Public Market in Uptown Charlotte. Greg, welcome.
Thank you. How are y'all? How's everybody?
Good. How are you?
Thanks for calling in, Greg.
No problem. I'm calling a little bit of a long work day, but it's all right. It's normal. So.
Oh, yeah. You wrapped up now?
Yeah, I'm cool. I'm outside. I got done with inventory and all of the crazy stuff that we had to do on a day-to-day basis. So.
Oh, good.
Looking forward to talking.
Oh, yeah. Man. So we're going to be seeing you in a couple of weeks at Charleston Wine and Food Festival. But we're really excited to learn a little bit more about what you're doing in Charlotte and then what you're thinking for Charleston and what you're most looking forward to at the festival.
So I guess I'll go backwards. I know that Charleston has always kind of been the Southern food town. So every time we go do an event there, I think it's very important to make sure that you come with your A game. You know, a lot of the big name chefs have come out of Charlotte or started in Charlotte as home. I mean, Charleston, excuse me, as home base. So I'm looking forward to just getting down there and cooking. And plus Kevin Mitchell, BJ Dennis, a few more folks are like, you know, some extended family. So I'm looking forward to doing that and hanging out with them a little bit while we're down there.
That's a fun crew for sure. So
Yeah. Go ahead.
So tell us about Uptown Yoke and why you decided to focus on breakfast food. I need to know.
So focusing on breakfast food was more of happenstance than a plan. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, born and raised. Kind of worked, you know, some mom and pop spots, hot wing joints while I was there. And then I went to culinary school in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I did the whole resort scene out there for like, you know, 5 or 6 years. And I wanted to come back because I felt like I had something in me and I missed the South and, you know, the good and the bad of the South. I just missed the South and I wanted to get back engaged back in the community and, you know, started using more Southern products and stuff. So when we were making that decision, Charlotte made sense. I think the food scene was at a place, but I don't think it had really developed into what it is now. And I wanted the opportunity to, well, versus going to Charleston, trying to fit in. I wanted to go to a place that I could create something or I could be a part of something that was being created. So when we moved to Charlotte, I was looking for jobs, couldn't find jobs. And we ended up finding this like hole in the wall, 1200 square feet diner. And I was like, this is going to be my farm to table 9-course soliloquy to Southern food. I'm a black chef. I was like, wow, I'm about to do some crazy stuff. And I went in with my wife, and we saw hot dogs on the grill and barbecue sauce on the walls. And she was like, yeah, babe, you got to do breakfast. So I went from wanting to do this huge, grand, farm-to-table restaurant in a small space with, like, 30 seats to having a wake-up call and realizing that the only way I really could get people to trust me is to try to present them with the best food I could present them with at a price point. I tell you to try something brand new for $100, you're going to be like, no, 10 bucks, maybe.
That's awesome. And I think that that's super spot on. I think that it's hard to bring this super outside-the-box concept to a town like Charlotte that just really wants to eat good food.
Absolutely. And we were in a suburb of Charlotte, right across the border in Rock Hill. So they had developed even less than Charlotte had developed. So it was, I didn't want to do it. I'm stubborn. But I married a woman who was more stubborn than me. So she was like, nah, if you're going to make me do this, we're going to do it where it makes sense. And even then, like, we started using stone ground grits before most of the people that were in Rock Hill were doing it. And we were working with local eggs, working with local farmers doing, you know, just like egg white omelets with local mushrooms and using local eggs. For a lot of people, that was new just because we actually went and tried to source those things locally.
So really quick, I have to ask you about Soul Food Sessions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Soul Food Sessions is a collective of African-American chefs who are trying to change the hospitality industry through mentorship, scholarship, and kind of just promotion of African-American chefs in different places. We all have worked in the fine dining industry before. Obviously, I had the breakfast restaurant. Three of the members had two different food trucks. And one of our pastry chef was kind of doing, I won't say simple, but like cupcakes and stuff like that. She really hadn't got the opportunity to show everybody what she could do. So we decided to do a dinner together. Our first dinner was four courses, and we specifically picked collard greens, chicken, stuff that was, you know, stereotypical in the, I guess, soul food, African-American, black food canon. So we picked those things to kind of push them a little bit. I even did a dish, was fried chicken skins with watermelon hot sauce. You know, obviously, watermelon and chicken skin is kind of really stereotypical. And we knew
that
it was going to be good, but yeah, and it was delicious, you know what I mean? But it was just one of those things to kind of push at a stereotype.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's where we started. Then last year we had the tour with Coca-Cola Consolidated, and now we're looking to, we had a great dinner at Charleston last year at the Dewberry. It was really fun. Everybody came out and supported, so it was really great.
Awesome. Very cool.
We're going to be seeing you in just a couple of weeks at the Springer Mountain Farms activation at Charleston Wine and Food. So you're going to be cooking on the fire pit, right? Any chance you can tease what you're making for us?
So one of the different things that I like to do as far as Southern food, I like to be able to push it a little bit just from my perspective. So I'm doing what I'm calling the Southern banh mi. So I love banh mi. I love Vietnam. I like the thought process of all ethnicities and cultures doing street food, like doing really cheap, interesting riffs on food. And the banh mi sandwich is one of those, you know, delicious things that we've kind of, I won't say we've Americanized it, but we've definitely taken it on as ours now. So I'm going to do a Southern banh mi. We're going to do a sweet potato biscuit, chicken liver pate with Springer Farms chicken. We're going to do some grilled chicken on top of that, some pickled local vegetables, and then we're going to do like a burnt pepper aioli. So kind of the pickled carrot, jalapeno, pate thing, but in a way that I think is going to be a little more approachable. And then when you really look at it, like biscuits and livers are kind of classic Southern anyway, so I'm just kind of playing a riff on both classic ingredients, both classic ideas. So.
Okay, well, just look out for a bunch of people running out of a podcast studio towards your setup. We're going to be asking for all the banh mi's.
Listen, I got you. I'm going to put something to the side. So
yes,
we'll
please
have like 10 or 15 of them in a to-go box.
Yeah, a little tray for us, please. Well, we're
I
really looking forward to that. That sounds amazing. And thank you so much. It's so nice to hear your voice and nice to meet you. And can't wait to see you at Charleston very soon.
Absolutely. I'm looking to come down and represent for Charlotte, so it's going to be fun.
All right. Sounds great. Take care. Thank you. We'll see you then.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, man.
I'm so hungry now.
Yeah. So hungry.
That was like my first little like moment where I like felt like it's really around the corner. Like,
oh, wait, we're going to Charleston.
I was doing a little bit of research today. I was looking up a place called Hannibal's Soul Food Kitchen in Charleston that I haven't been to before. And I think that might be on my list of places to go to. But I feel like we're going to be really lucky in having apparently very good food at the Culinary Village this year, if Greg has anything to say about it.
I'm excited because last year, the funny thing is you don't realize how hungry you're going to be during a food festival because you're busy and everyone is giving you small tastings.
Anna's like, yes.
When
yes.
you're working the food festival, Anna knows. It's a lot different than when you're like eating. Yeah.
And thank God last year, our dearest darling, Shai Farjian, brought us
another
an
Charlotte
entire
guy.
Tray of like beautiful couscous salad, and I remember eating it with a tiny little bamboo fork. Like, I love you, thank you so
much. It
was
like five of us gathered around this foil tray of couscous, just like shoveling it in. It was like 5 o'clock, and
but he was like the only one
Shai
who got
saved
it.
Saved us,
yeah. So now we've like, got Greg on our team.
Yeah, everyone was like, "Oh, we'll bring you like a taste of this," and Shai's like, "I know what they need: an entire tray of real food."
Yes,
and it's true.
So good.
The first year of Slow Food Nations, after the first big dinner, everyone was eating and partying, and we were all working. It was like 11 p.m. and I'm like, I am hungry.
Yeah,
I'm like, I went out to some place and just got a sandwich, and I'm like, I don't know, I have not eaten at all today.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
I think I know that some festivals put together, not necessarily festivals so much as like I went to the Southern Foodways Alliance symposium, which is just one day of programming. And so they put together this really nice, like, where to go eat out the rest of the weekend. And I think that for festivals, obviously, you're going to be there all day. Most people are going to be eating all day. But for people working the festival, it would be super great to put together, like, a late night cheat sheet. Because that's when you actually get the opportunity to go eat.
Or when to get fast food, like good fast food. Like, I don't want to wait. I can't wait in a line. Just
I can't sit down. I can't go in.
I don't want to be in the car for half an hour. I just need to eat.
Where can I go find something good?
We've gotten better as the festival matures of like having catering in the office. So when Smart. You stop by, you can grab something and go.
Yeah. All right. Well, all this festival talk has just got me like so hungry fun. And like a little bit like psychologically exhausted. I think I'm like fast forwarding to like ends of days, but I'm super excited. I'm like ready to go. We're now gonna do some trivia. So in relation to the Plant a Seed campaign, Aaliyah, our new intern, has done an incredible job writing some trivia based on the Arc of Taste.
Wow.
And who has not seen the answers?
I have not seen the answers.
I also have not.
All right.
So we're your team.
Yes.
Great.
All right.
She's like, great.
All right.
Are you feeling confident in your team?
Okay, let's go.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Question number one. What is another name for the groundnut, the main ingredient in the iconic Charleston street candy known as the groundnut cake?
The groundnut.
Yeah.
This is a type of peanut, right?
Correct.
Is that the answer?
A plus.
Correct. That one really makes me think of David Shields. I think he's like a big fan of the groundnut.
Yep.
Him and Glenn Roberts.
But it's not another name. Isn't it a different type? I mean, is there a difference between the groundnut and the peanut?
I think they're like cousins.
Okay.
I think it's like a variety, like a tangential variety. Right. Yes. I think it's supposed to be sweeter than a peanut. Is that right?
Didn't we have some in Charleston 2 years ago?
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's smaller, right?
I think
I feel
so.
Like when I was in Uganda, they had a G-nut. They call it G-nut stew. It's like a really delicious, soup.
Interesting.
I don't know if you guys can hear, like, all of this talk is just like my stomach rumbling.
We're almost there.
Okay.
All right. Question number two. In Alaska, where maples are scarce, a different tree is used to make the syrup included in the Arc of Taste. What kind of trees does this syrup come from?
Ooh.
Do you know?
A maple-like
tree that makes syrup.
A sappy
common
tree.
In Alaska.
In Alaska.
Is it some kind of birch? I don't know. Like, birch? Is it a birch?
It's a birch.
Okay. Is that the answer, or is it a specific
type
of birch?
It's a birch tree, Alaskan birch.
Because I was thinking about like beer, like you make birch beer, so there must be like some kind of flavorful, sappy.
So it's, I believe the Alaskan birch syrup is what's on the Arc of Taste. So it's the Arc of Taste is like not necessarily always a seed. It can be
a food product. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Question number three. From what state's cuisine did at least 7 items in the Ark of Taste originate, including varieties of cream cheese, French bread, strawberries, and merlotons? Is that how you say it?
I've got an idea. Because you said French bread, it's got to... Well, what do you think?
No, go ahead. I was going to say New York, but I just love New York. Oh. And I feel like everything... No.
Everything's from New York.
Yeah, I vote Louisiana.
I was going to say Louisiana.
Correct.
Ah. Yeah.
Would the French bread be like the types of bread that you use on like a po' boy?
It's got to be, right? Because so. we have a whole thing on Modernist Breadcrumbs about types of regional bread.
But it's po' boy bread is like a specific bread.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the same as a baguette.
But it's a variation.
And it's also different than a hoagie.
Yeah.
Which is also, speaking of banh mi, also used in banh mi because the French colonized Vietnam. And so that's when the bread came
over. A po' boy and a banh mi are like cousins. All these foods are cousins.
Po' boy is to banh mi as ground nut is to peanut.
You got it now. All right. Question number 4. Although these tiny husked heirlooms are technically tomatoes, they are so sweet that they're named after a fruit popular in pies. The Ark of Taste includes a Polish variety called Aunt Molly's.
What is the ground cherry?
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes. We actually included the Aunt Molly ground cherry in the Plant a Seed Kit year 1.
Oh.
And I tried to grow it at home, and it was a complete failure.
No. Oh, no.
I think that was the year I had a 1-year-old at home. I was not paying attention to my garden, so
yeah.
Raising another kind of seed.
Pro tip: that's not actually a pro, but I learned this when I tried to grow tomatillos, which is closely related. Mm-hmm. You have to have 2 of them. You can't grow a single tomatillo. Okay. So take note. I think that I once grew a 1 ground cherry, and it was rather prolific, but I think if you have at least 2 side by side, they'll do a lot better.
It's a problem in New York.
Your precious deck square footage, but maybe 1 more container, or maybe just let them lean out the sides.
Yeah, they're really popular with school gardens because they're fun for kids to kind of unwrap, and they're sweet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little present.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next question. Can you name 2 of the 7 breeds of turkeys included in the Ark of Taste catalog?
2 of the 7 breeds.
I should call Patrick for this one.
I know. I've got to know
the
this.
The red.
Bourbon red.
That's 1.
Bourbon red. Okay.
New Hampshire something.
There's not a New Hampshire something. But
it's not on the Ark of Taste. Okay, that must be one of Patrick's.
I think I might know. It might be New Hampshire something.
The bourbon red. Oh, there's so many more, though.
There's a couple more that are like colors.
There's a bronze.
Yes, it's a... what kind of bronze?
It's a...
What country are we in?
Are we playing Mad Libs?
American bronze?
Yes.
American bronze.
Bourbon red. This could also be like whiskeys.
Yeah, there's a white one, right?
There's a midget white.
Oh.
There's a black, just black. There's a Jersey buff.
Jersey buff.
A Narragansett.
Narragansett, of course.
A royal palm. And a slate.
Maybe that should be my next campaign.
Plant a turkey.
The grill a turkey campaign. I send out boxes.
Boxes of turkey eggs.
Just chicks, like turkey chicks.
You know, when I was growing up, we raised turkeys growing up. And we used to go pick up our turkey turkeys at the post office.
At the postal service,
it was
right?
So fun, yeah.
We didn't raise them growing up, but I grew up like in a pretty rural area, and my dad decided to have turkeys once, and so we had 2 of them. And I have a photo of me as like a 3-year-old sitting on the back of a turkey.
Who's
like,
bigger?
Riding it.
Why?
Size.
Yeah.
Why is this not like your staff photo on our website?
That's what I want
to know. Seriously?
It's like, and I have this look on my face like, what? Like,
I bet, I can't speak for Patrick, but I bet if you gave them that photo, they would give you a turkey for Thanksgiving.
Maybe I should do that next year.
I think you should.
Because I'm now up to 2 turkeys for Thanksgiving because we have so many people that want to eat turkey. So I need whatever turkey discount I can get.
We do the side-by-side mini turkeys, too, which is always nice because they don't take as long to cook and they're tender. So we do, double 9s.
Yes. I approve that message. Okay, next question. What are the green, often foraged alliums that the Ark of Taste calls the harbingers of spring?
Man, I know so many people who know all these questions. The snap of a finger.
This is like, this is the thing that pops up on high-end menus because it's like trendy.
Oh.
Ramps.
Ramps.
Oh, ramps.
Ramps. Wild ramps, which are funny that they call them wild ramps because you can't really have domestic ramps. Like, that's the whole thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can try, but like, they don't grow very well. They have to be kind of in a swamp-ish place.
All right, you got a couple more questions. What is the name for the concentrated syrup made from fruit, vinegar, and sugar that was a popular day drink in colonial times and has today seen a resurgence for use in specialty cocktails? Hint, it's also a name for a bush or a small tree.
It's something you might find when you're foraging for ramps in the near vicinity.
You can get them at Husk.
At the same time?
I'm not a bush, I'm a shrub.
That's right. Oh, sorry.
Oh. Wait for the ding.
All right. Last question. I didn't see this question until just now. This is a really good addition, Leah. You're going to find out why it's a good question in a minute. What ruminants can be found in YouTube videos displaying a behavior known as myotonia congenita, where their muscle cells contract and they fall over suddenly?
Oh yeah.
The breed has been valued for having excellent meat to bone ratio and very little body fat.
Also, I'm sure they will one day be our pet. Chris, if you're still listening, I think you're probably like bursting right now.
Hannah?
Meh. Meh.
That's goat for
I forget what the fainting goats are called.
That's the fainting goats.
That's what I have. AKA.
My spirit animal.
Myotonic. I think I'm saying that right. Tennessee fainting.
I think it's myotonic.
Myotonic. Or they're also known
muscles.
As.
Here goes my phone.
They're also known as the Texas wooden leg stiff, nervous, and scare goats. What? Is that the whole name?
Shut Texas up. Wood legs.
Stiff, nervous, and scared.
That's the Latin.
Possible names.
Oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wait, oh, but is it gosh. Texas wood leg or Texas goat?
Texas wood leg? Goat?
Is there a comma? I don't.
It says AKA myotonic Tennessee fainting Tennessee meat Texas wooden leg stiff, nervous, and scare goats.
Can you read that again? Texas really wooden
leg. It sounds really stressful to be a Texas wooden leg stiff and scare meat.
I had some neighbors growing up that had some fainting goats. It just seemed like you had them to torture them, which I didn't.
I feel really bad about it because, like, yeah, it's sort of, I don't know. Maybe you do it once and then it's just kind of mean.
Then you're
after
like,
that.
Aw,
I don't know.
Poor guy. But that's really in the work. Arc of Taste.
I didn't know that they were for eating.
Well, they have.
I mean, they're probably.
Well, guys,
maybe that originated because they were easy.
They're easy to catch.
They have excellent meat to bone ratio and very little body fat.
But actually, that was part of why they were popular, is they wouldn't climb fences and get into trouble like all other goats like to do.
They're self-regulating goats.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow.
Do they make good apartment animals?
I'm sure they would love to cohabitate with our wild young lab. I think that would go over really well.
I have a goat theory. The cuter the name you give a goat, the more demonic it is.
I think that's accurate.
We had a goat named Pudding growing up, and it was the devil incarnate. That's all I have to say for the rest of the show.
Well, we've got it. Anna, you won trivia. Congratulations. And
I like the Grow Turkey campaign. Maybe I'll run with that.
I'm on board. Just don't send them things through. Don't send them through the mail service. If we've learned anything today, it's that the post office is not going to get things to people on time. And you want them to get to people on time.
And
hand delivered turkeys. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you guys saw any social media from our host party back in January, where we enjoyed a pretty solid turducken that was spun out of a Meat and Three episode that we did. But
and
stay tuned
not
for,
on the Arc of
for
Taste.
Turkey related updates from Charleston. Just saying.
Turkey related updates?
From and Charleston? Turducken.
Oh.
We have a surprise coming. Yeah, it's your idea, so I'm surprised. Yeah, remember that idea you had.
Remember
that
your
was
idea.
So good.
Remember the idea that I had that now I don't remember because
we're doing it.
I'm so much further into planning.
Be careful what you say around here. I guess is the moral.
Yes.
Now they're doing it.
Well, yeah, it's happening.
The hint is Cynthia Wong is a genius. All right, that's our foreshadowing.
Teaser, teaser. We will see you next Thursday for another installment of HRN Happy Hour. Huge thank you to Anna Moulet for being our guest today.
Pleasure.
Sharing the word about Slow Food Nations and Slow Food Plant a Seed. I hope that you will all go and get your Plant a Seed kit, because $35 is really an amazing way to get a hold of these incredibly wonderful seeds that you otherwise would have to like come up to Stone Barns for, which you can also do, which is lovely.
you can't beat it.
You really
and
can't.
And source from many different companies.
Yeah. So check it out and stay tuned next week for more of HRN Happy Hour. I'll see you next Thursday. Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Unless we're real fucked up, let's drink the night away, away. I was told all the times that I had no hope. I was told a thousand times that I made no hope. I you a million times that I made no hope.
HRN Happy Hour is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.